I'm Angela Owens and welcome to In Case You Missed It. Today, as part of NAIDOC Week, we're bringing you stories about Indigenous life, culture and history you may have missed during the year. We meet two young Indigenous women working to preserve their culture and close the gap. We find out just how tough it is to find love in the Kimberley, because if you're single and black, there's a good chance that hot guy you want to date may actually be your cousin. And Stan Yeramunya shares his life story. He spent just 2 weeks at school, grew up poor and surrounded by addiction. But he's had the most extraordinary life that's included meeting Bono from U2.
So I made it my business to make him a ditch. So I'm walking in the Park Hyatt Hotel, this black car's coming out, the window comes down, he looks at me and he goes, "Are you looking for me?" I said, "Yeah, I am actually."
Stay tuned if you want to hear what happened next. The theme this year for NAIDOC Week has been Because of Her, We Can. It's given us the chance to look back on the contributions Indigenous women have made in the past. Well, two young Indigenous Australians are also working hard to preserve Indigenous culture into the future. Hamish McDonald from RN Breakfast spoke with entrepreneur Michaela Jade from Indigital and Evelyn Araluan, a poet and teacher of Indigenous literature at Sydney University. He began by asking Evelyn if recognition of Indigenous women was long overdue.
Oh, massively long overdue. I think the more important question now that we've got that, though, is about how we can sustain that and how we can sustain that energy and that support and the necessity of centering Aboriginal women consistently in that dialogue as matriarchs, as survivors, as, you know, just a consistently resilient force in our culture and in our broader Australian community. So I'm really excited to see it.
I want to know a bit about the work that you do. I suppose we all know about the importance of storytelling in Indigenous culture, but you are specifically looking at Indigenous literature pre-colonisation. Is that right?
Well, I look at a lot of my work is about expanding what we actually conceive of as literature. And a lot of that work is about actually addressing the fact that, you know, we have a history which is time immemorial, and that history carries with it so many stories and so many different marks of our presence on our country. Some of that's oral, some of that is visual, like some of that you can go and you can walk through country and see that, some of it is spiritual. So I work a lot on how we can actually expand what we understand as being literature in our universities and outside of educational institutions as well, how we can, you know, walk through story and how we can carry that with us in ways we wouldn't have expected.
But you also do really, I guess, kind of common things like run poetry nights.
Yeah, and that's a lot of fun. That's a lot of fun. Sometimes we get kicked out of the pubs. Sometimes we're like, "Hey, white supremacy." And then people are like, "No, I like white supremacy. Like, leave, please. You're annoying us." But it's really amazing work to see, like, so many young Aboriginal people who are, like, there and have voices, and so many Aboriginal women as well who've, like, "Hey, I've got something to say, give me a space to say it," and they're so unbelievably ready.
Michaela Jade, tell us about your work. You run a tech firm, it's based in a remote area. How did that happen and what do you do?
So what I do first is probably easier to ask. I use cutting-edge technology platforms and systems to share Indigenous culture within communities. So we look at how can we use cutting-edge tech to translate Indigenous knowledge systems from older generations to younger generations using really cool stuff like augmented and mixed realities. And we also use the platforms to be able to share Aboriginal cultural knowledge systems on country and off country with other people. The way that I got involved in it was I grew up not knowing my heritage, so I didn't really discover my Aboriginal roots until I was 29, which is quite late in life.
Was that a surprise to you?
Well, it was and it wasn't. So I was always in the bush as a kid, and I used to spend a lot of time with Aboriginal carvings that were in the bush near my house. And I also got identified my whole life as being from Aboriginal heritage, and so it wasn't until lots of aunties along my journey in national parks said to me, "Where are you from?" And it happened just so many times I realised that I needed to find out who I was. So at 29, I found out that I am a descendant of the Cabrigal people from the Georges River area in Sydney. So I really, when that happened, I I reflected back to my time with the petroglyphs on country and just thought, why do we put aluminium signs on particularly national park sites that tell the story of Indigenous peoples through the lens of an archaeologist? Why aren't Aboriginal people telling our own stories? So when I saw augmented reality, I thought, wow, this could be a really groundbreaking way to be able to achieve that, where you put your phone up to a cultural place or an artwork or an object, and our own people can share our own stories in our own way.
We talk a lot, I guess, generally about getting more women into tech. You yep. have sort of gone streaks ahead here. You're employing other females as well. You're sort of building these big projects. I mean, you're really kind of, crossing a lot of barriers in every respect.
Yeah, well, I think it's really important that our women have a place in the technology sector, and just women in general, actually, because only 28% of the industry is female, which is quite terrifying. And females are going to be the most disproportionately affected by technology-based automation. So 57% of jobs in the future, and not even a distant future, like in 8.5 years. So anything in customer service, administration and education is going to have a huge impact on the way that we work. And the way that we work means the way that we get money. So it's really important that we have opportunities to diversify our skill set so we can fit into workplaces of the future.
Michaela Jade speaking to Hamish McDonald from RN Breakfast. When Molly was just 17 and looking for a boyfriend, she found the perfect boy. But because they were both Aboriginal and lived in the Kimberley, things became complicated. Molly found out the hard way, you have to check your family tree before you fall for someone in a town like Broome.
I was a hormonal 17-year-old girl in love with the boy of my dreams. He was athletic. He was adorable. He was so funny. And he was my cousin. Yep, I said cousin. I was head over heels for a boy who was related to me by my mother's mother's second cousin's daughter's nephew's cousin brother. You must be confused. See, I'm an Aboriginal woman. That means I have a large family, which is great. But there is one problem. Before you can date, God forbid even hold hands with another Aboriginal person, you need to check, are we related? And the reason why I'm telling you this, because I need advice. I've recently developed a little crush on an Aboriginal boy from the Kimberley.
Hey Molly, how you going?
Hi Darren, I'm well. I see we have mutual friends. Have we met before?
Yeah, don't you remember me? I was at Jessica's party last weekend.
As we conversed, I stalked his profile. Purely for research, of course. He's attractive. Tick. He's a black fella. Nice. Tick. We continue to text, and he's actually pretty funny. I think I like him.
So I was wondering, what you doing next Saturday night?
Saturday night? Probably nothing. What for?
You want to come to the movies with me?
What? Like a date?
Yeah, like a date. I'll pick you up at 8.
Oh, okay, sounds good. I'll see you then. Well, 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 I have a date with a handsome black man. I'm feeling quite good. Oh my gosh, I didn't even ask him who his mob is. I didn't ask. Damn it. So I'm here, sitting down on my bed, hot and bothered, with someone who may be my cousin, my uncle, my grandfather. I have no idea. Times like this when I wish there was a guide on how to date a black fella in the Kimberley. I can't believe there's not a single guide on blackfella love conundrums. I wonder what they would sound like.
So you like someone, and you're itchy for that person, eh? But you're not too sure if you're related. Well, these are the steps on how to date another Aboriginal in the Kimberley. Step 1. Find someone that feels mutually attracted towards you. Step 2. Before initiating any sort of contact, like coffee, movies, dinner, even hand-holding, always ask your parents the number one question. Are we related? Step 3. To avoid any incestual relationship, look through the family tree and connect the dots. Trace back, way back. Even if they are related through your second cousin's mother's auntie's son's daughter, that still counts. Step 4. If your parents are unsure, consult with an elder, like your grandparents. Look for the following. Related? Are they your right skins? Is that right way? And lastly, show respect. If any of your relatives already dated them, give up and walk away because you can't go there. Step 5. By now you should know if you are related or not. If you are and you say, but it's distance, and proceed to go ahead, then you are proper itchy. Step 6. If the research has been a success and you are not blood, then it's time to ask the person out, which is generally done by saying,
hey, you pop a lovely thing, eh? Can I meet you or what?
Translates into, hello there, I think you're very beautiful, and I was wondering if I could take you out on a date. You have now learned the steps on how to date an Aboriginal person in the Kimberley.
But unfortunately, there aren't any guides. So much dating is trial and error. Well, I think it's time to ask my mother.
Hey, look at you. Something wrong with you today? You're looking a bit... I know, you're looking a bit smiley.
Nah, I don't know what you're talking about.
Hey, look here, you're looking a bit smiley, a little bit, you know, dressing up a bit there.
Ah, what, I can't look good for myself, or what?
Nah, I reckon there's something else. Come on, what now? Tell us.
Well, here's this boy I met the other day. He's good looking.
I thought so. But wait there. Is he a black fella or is he a white fella?
Black.
Where from?
I think he's from here.
Family? Do you know his family?
Nah.
Well, do you know who his mob is, you know, from his grandfather's side or his grandmother's side?
Oh, I didn't know I had to be a big detective on the first date.
Well, you know, you got to ask him before you even go on that first date. You don't even know. You know that you might be related.
Oh, what do you want me to do?
Well, first you got to ask him, who's your father's mob? You could ask him who's his mother mob. You know, look at his face sometime. Look at his face. Some of our mob, they look the same. They do. Look at that nose. Look at them foot. He might have the same foot as you. Got to go right back. Even country. Right back to country.
What should I do? Should I text him?
Nah, don't text him. Actually, why don't you bring him over? Look, I'll track him down. This mob... right down to his dog or his cat or anything, if you have any animal pets or something.
And if we are related?
Sorry, bub. That's where the cookie crumbles.
So I did my research. I rang my grandmother, who asked her cousin's sister, who asked her nephew, and confirmed my suspicions. Turns out, we're cousins. Second cousins, to be exact. Damn. He was so attractive. Well... I told Darren, and as I expected it would go, it was extremely, extremely awkward. And what I've learned through my very weird, very awkward journey of this whole situation is always ask your family. Do your homework, do your research. But I've also accepted being a black fella in the Kimberley, it's inevitable to date someone you're related to. And maybe that's okay. Maybe that's not. If it gets too complicated, just date a white person.
Molly Hunt, who's an ABC radio presenter in Broome, on the difficulties of finding blackfella love in the Kimberleys. Sometimes you meet people who have had the most extraordinary lives. Stan Yeramunya is one of those. His story begins with a loving mum and an alcoholic and wandering dad. For most of his life, Stan lived in poverty. He barely went to school. He developed an addiction. But he found a community, a job, acquired a new name, and his life turned around. Stan is a Wotherong man, and he's written his life story. It's titled A Man Called Yarra. I hope wherever you are right now that you will listen to this interview with Amanda Smith from Life Matters, because I guarantee you it'll make you laugh and cry and have you cheering Stan on.
I grew up in Swan Hill.
In Victoria?
In Victoria, yes. I was in Swan Hill. And my mother and father, we lived on an orchard where they used to pick grapes and stuff like that. And then my father left, and then we went down to Ballarat. And at the age of 7, I met up with him again. And then from there, I remember my mother and father having a bit of an argument. And then before you know it, I was on a highway hitchhiking from Ballarat to Adelaide.
At what age were you?
I was 7 years old, yeah. And I remember sleeping out on the side of the road the first night when we couldn't get a ride. And I said to myself, when I'm a big boy, I'm going to drive my own car. And I meant what I said, because I wasn't going to rely on anybody.
So now this was with your dad. You were kind of on the road with your dad. Your dad was a white guy, your mother an Indigenous woman.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So you know, you write all about this in, the story of your life so far in a memoir that's just come out called A Man Called Yarra. And you really describe how your father, Frankie was his name, was a kind of restless person, wasn't he? Couldn't settle in one place for any length of time. And as you say, you joined him often on the road along with your siblings at various times.
Yeah.
Why do you think your dad, you know, was so, why was your dad so restless? And why did he take you with him?
Yeah, well, he said he'd never want another man to bring up his children. So he grabbed me first, and then we went on the road for a couple of years, and we went back and got my brother David, and we went back and got my other sister Lynette. And then we just kept travelling, and, you know, my mum had the federal police after us for so many years looking for us. They finally caught up with us up in Sydney, and they took my brother and sister back to Melbourne, and they left me with my father because my mother knew that I would be fretting too much for my father, because, you know, I just needed to be with him because he was a really good man. We've had a lot of experiences together, and they were good experiences. I didn't do a lot of schooling and stuff like that, probably done 2 weeks of schooling, yeah. But it didn't stop me from doing anything I wanted to do. Because like I said earlier, when I said I was 7, I'm going to drive my own car. So nothing sort of is
quite
in my
flash
barrier.
Car too.
Yeah, I've had a couple of nice ones. And I only done that because of the experiences I've had when I worked with certain people. I remember working at the water board one time, and this guy started to tell a story about Aboriginal people living in his mate's place and burning a hole in the middle of the floor. He really humiliated me. And I thought to myself, I'm going to prove it to you that we're not like that. But I don't have to do that today. But that's what I thought back then. And I remember buying this car 15 years later. I put up at the stoplights, and he put up beside me in a garbage truck. And I looked up at him and said, "Yeah, well, that's the way it rolls." You know what I mean? It's not good to be judging people and pointing the finger at everybody. You know, when you look at yourself, I think people do that because they're not comfortable with themselves. And that's why I like to just keep pushing things forward. I come from the oldest living culture in the world, and I'm proud to be an Aboriginal man. And I never have to prove anything to anybody because, you know, after all, we're just another grain of sand on the beach. Nobody's that special. You know what I mean?
Your childhood, though, just to stick with that for a moment, I mean, you know, being sort of on the move constantly with your dad.
Yeah.
And also, your dad was a very heavy drinker.
Yes, he was.
So, you know, there were times when he'd be, you know, passed out in the park, and if you saw the cops coming, you'd have to sort of pretend to be playing so that they, you know, they thought
you'd
keep
driving past and think that he was just passed out. He was just laying to have an arrest, and I'd get up doing somersaults and this and that, and the police would look at me, and I'd look at them, wave at them, and they'd give me a bit of a smile, thinking, what's going on here? But they'd just keep driving, and I'd say, Dad, quick, get up, we're going to go. So I'd get him up, and, you know, he'd be drunk, and I'd take him around and put him up a laneway somewhere and just leave him there and then come back later and pick him up, and then we'd end up at another place. But, you know, he was an alcoholic. It killed him at the age of 44. But he was a very, very good, strong worker as well. And I remember the people that on my journey that he introduced me to said, your dad's a really good worker. So that ethic came into my thought, and I'm always going to be a worker. I'm not going to rely on other people is my thing. Yeah.
Well, the other thing that you did pick up from your father was that for a time you took up alcohol.
Yes.
In a big way, Stan. Mm-hmm. Which, on one hand, I mean, did for a time keep you from living up to your potential, but on the other, it actually brought you closer to your Indigenous culture, in that you were doing a couple of days a week work cleaning and cooking at Galliamble. Now, this was a centre for Aboriginal people with addictions in St Kilda in Melbourne. During that time, what did you get in the sort of cultural awareness? They had training programs, I think, that resonated with you.
Yeah, they did. They had art classes there and things like that. And I felt like, with myself, I'm sort of like on a journey, and I was sort of like put there anyway to learn. That's where I really got more involved with the culture, because There was an art teacher there, and I was doing some painting and over the weekend, and she came in on the Monday and she goes, "Oh, who done this?" I said, "Oh, I did," and you know, she liked it and she bought it from me. And back then I was thinking to myself, gee, this is all right, I can make some money from this, you know, not realising that I was actually getting more and more involved with my culture. So I've always believed that my ancestors are sort of with me and certain other people that want to get for us to get out there and share our culture with the wider community, because it's a good culture to be a part of, you know. It's our culture, it's Australia's culture, and you know, that's my responsibility to do as much as I can every day. Even doing this interview with you right now is like the people that are listening, it makes them more aware of the culture that's in their country, you know. It's they're beautiful. You know, I've been to Alice Springs and places like that, and I've seen the way the brothers and sisters up there do all their art and everything, and it just blows my mind to be a part of that.
Well, now, your name, Yaramunya, wasn't always how you were known. You were Stanny Dryden.
That's it, yeah.
How did you come to get Yaramunya as your name?
Yeah, well, that also happened at Gallyamble as well. There's an older guy there from South Australia. His name was Robert Mate, and he'd be watching me there. He was actually a client in this place. And he'd be looking at me and he'd be saying to me, mate, he goes, Yaramunya. And I'm looking around like, he said, yeah, you, Yaramunya. I said, what does that mean? He goes, wise man. He said, that's your name. I go, why are you saying that about me? And he goes, because I watch you and, you know, you're doing the things that, you know, Aboriginal men do. You know, you're trying to help your community by being in this place, and the way you speak and the way you address yourself, that's the name I'm giving you. And I was, you know, I've just kept that name. And
did that sit right with you at the time? I mean, you know, that's quite a bit to live up to.
It is, yeah. At that age, I didn't think I was that wise. But as the journey goes on, I realise that name does fit today, because I am doing a lot of good things in for my community and my and myself and my own personal family, you know. My children haven't seen me drink, a lot of them, you know.
When did you get off the grog?
I was the 5th of August 1993. I was 28 years old. I was ready to launch and go for it, but something brought me to my knees, and that's where it all changed for me, yeah.
Mm. Now, throughout your life, starting with your mum, Charlotte, there have been significant women who've really seen the best in you too. Talking about your mother, you say people's dreams disappear, women's dreams more than most. Can you tell us what prompted that reflection?
Yeah, well, my mother probably had a dream of having her husband and children all together, and it didn't work out like...
You all right? Would you like to talk about something else, Stan? I've just touched a...
Yeah, sorry.
..a rawness in you.
My mother is very strong.
Mm. This is a bit rough. We can come back to it if you like. I don't want to.
Yeah, no. She's a very strong woman, and she never had the opportunity to look after her children.
Yeah. It's a great sadness and source of sorrow for you, and perhaps I shouldn't have asked you about that.
No, that's okay. It's just I don't realise what I'm talking. Just like this book, it's been a bit of a roller coaster for a couple of years talking with Robert Hillman and getting it out. And
This is your co-author.
Yeah, and the whole thing comes out, and it's like I didn't realise how many things I've done in my life, and you know, and there's reasons for what I've done, and I know that, you know, I'm meant to keep doing this sort of stuff in honour of my mother as well, because she was a strong Aboriginal woman, and I'm very proud to say that I'm the son of Charlotte Charles. Yeah.
Well, you talked about taking up painting when you were at Gallyamble, but your creativity is sort of touched across multiple disciplines, really. As well as the painting, there's been music and dancing and some acting. Now, the acting was prompted by you saw Ernie Dingo in the movie The Fringe Dwellers.
Yeah.
Tell us about that moment of seeing an Aboriginal man on your TV.
Yeah, well, I was watching him and I thought to myself, geez, if he could do that, I could do that too. Not realising you have to go to study for schooling and reading and scripts and all that sort of stuff. That's the sort of person that I am. I'll just give it a go. Once I think about it, I'll go for it. And I don't taken over an airspace. I'll say, oh, no, you can't do this, you can't do that. I go, well, no, well, then I'll do it. And then they go, how did you do that? And I go, well, you know, you weren't interested before, so it's okay, I'll let you go, and I'll stick with the people that have got the encouragement, and I'll stick with people like that, the positive people, and I keep driving it forward. And to see him on TV, I thought, gee, that's good. And then, so anyway, 2 weeks later, I rang up ABC, I think it was, a Dinah Mann, I think her name was. And
so you just rang up ABC TV?
Yeah, and she goes, come down and I'll have a chat
with
you.
How old were you?
At that time, I think I was about 26.
Mm.
So I went to the studios there, and you know, I was on Flying Doctors. And
I mean, how did that happen, though? You know, you just ring up.
Just ring up. She said, come down. She said, read this script. I couldn't read it. So I said, I'll come back in a couple of days.
You couldn't read it because?
Because I can't read. Mm. So I said, I'll come back. She liked the look of the way I was at that time. And she goes, go away, learn it, and come back. So I went away, learned it, come back. Miss Sophia, my beautiful wife, she read the script to me, and I went back and I
spoke. So you memorised it?
Memorised it. I got a good memory. Mm-hmm. So then I went in and done the audition, and she goes, I'll ring up Channel 7, Grundy's, and I was on Flying Doctors within 3 weeks, 4 weeks of making that phone call. And then I started with Hugh Jackman in Corralie, and Barry Humphries in Welcome to Whoop Whoop, Blue Heelers, Law of the Land, and it just sort of just kept going. In theatre, I'd done a play called Stolen, and that went for like 5 or 6 years.
With all these, you know, all this television and the theatre, then how were you learning scripts?
How was I learning? I'd go away and I'd get Sophia to learn it to me, and then I'd go back the next day and do it. We had Ted Emery from Full Frontal, Fast Forward. He was going to offer me a role for 12 months on Full Frontal, and so I'd go on guest appearance all the time. And he just said to me in a conversation, you'd be right to read the monitor and stuff like that. I said, oh, I actually don't read. He goes, how you been doing this, mate? And I just said, oh, just go away, learn it, come back. He goes, all right, then we'll just keep bringing you back as a guest appearance. So that's when I was with Eric Banner and all those guys, and it was a good journey.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the journey's still on. There's lots more of that sort of stuff to come on, I believe, yeah.
So, you know, you can mix all this stuff up. You run an art gallery. You represent Indigenous artists.
Yeah.
The acting, the music, that all is of a piece for you somehow?
It's all a part of art. It's all there's no limit to art, so you can do whatever you like with it. So that's what I've been doing.
Mm.
Just keep going one step ahead of the next and doing my best. Have I done my best day's work yet? Yes, and I'm just going to keep doing it if I can.
Well, the music put you in touch with not only connecting you to your culture, but with people like Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, that was
tell us about meeting him.
I met him at the Cranker Centre 10 years earlier, and then like later on in time I met him again. They flew me up to Sydney, and I performed with him.
You were playing didgeridoo?
I was playing the didgeridoo, yeah. He was singing Superstitious, and I was playing the didge. And I got like 20,000 people out in front of me. My lips started to go numb. I'm thinking, geez, what's going on here? I can't believe I got Stevie Wonder sitting beside me and I'm playing this dude. Just like unbelievable. And I had the privilege of meeting Bono as well, because I heard him say, I can't change the world, but I know the people that can. So I made it my business to make him a dude. So I'm walking in the Park Hyatt Hotel. This black car's coming out. The window comes down. He looks at me and he goes, are you looking for me? I said, yeah, I am actually. So I grabbed the ditch, put it through the window. He jumps out, gives me a cuddle, and he goes, where are you off to now? So I just come and give you the ditch. I said, where are you going? And he said, I'm going to Etihad Stadium. So I just jumped in the car with him, went to Etihad Stadium, had a chat with him about what he said.
And getting a cuddle from him.
Yeah, whatever, yeah, it was great. Yeah.
How about that?
Had the privilege to meet a lot of people like that. It's great.
What a truly extraordinary life. Stan Yarramunya there, an artist, a businessman, an actor, philanthropist and musician who shared the stage and car ride with some of the world's greatest performers. He spoke with Amanda Smith on Life Matters earlier this year. For the past few weeks, Rear Vision has been tracing the story of the relationship between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians from the arrival of the First Fleet to the present. In the third and final instalment, the story begins in 1972 with the struggle for land rights. On the 26th of January of that year, four young Aboriginal men travelled to Canberra, sat under a beach umbrella outside Parliament House, and established the Tent Embassy.
It's more than this piece of grass. It's about every Aboriginal person in this country. It's about us as a sovereign people. It is about us as traditional owners. It's about how do we share this country with non-Aboriginal Australians.
Well, they arrived here early in the morning and they were met by people like Charles Perkins and some of the local Trades and Labour Council members who provided them with some umbrellas. And that was really the beginning of the protest, because they named the umbrellas the Aboriginal Embassy.
When the Prime Minister of the day, Billy McMahon, refused to acknowledge that the communities of the Northern Territory are entitled to have land rights, that's when the four Aboriginal men, Billy Craigie, Michael Anderson, Bertie Williams, went down and raised the breach umbrella. Within a matter of days, that area was just swarming with Aboriginal people. It was like a magnet.
What became noticeable with the tent embassy was that trespass laws were broken. People set up a tent embassy in front of Parliament House, or what is now Old Parliament House. And the police were called in to remove them, and the police were particularly brutal and violent. And that drew the attention of other countries. The news was broadcast internationally.
In 1972, Aboriginal land rights came right to the seat of government. Violence erupted as police, acting on a cabinet decision, removed the original Aboriginal tent embassy.
The response of Australians up until that point had been, especially during the Freedom Rides of 1965, our Aborigines don't riot like the Negroes do. That was actually reported in one of the newspapers. But the difference was that the police were brought in at the tent embassy, and the age of television broadcast the brutality. And so that made people sit up and pay attention, because it was very embarrassing to Australians. As they thought it, they had their first riot. Well, of course, that wasn't true. There'd been many riots before that. It's just that they were never reported. The term used for Aboriginal people back then was the forgotten people. So the tent embassy came as quite a shock to them.
What's your comment on the difference between your proposals for Aborigines and the Liberals' proposals?
The basic thing is, firstly, that the Liberals will not acknowledge the right of Aborigines to hold a collective title to traditional lands. We do believe in Aboriginal land rights.
Consider the optics. The McMahon government sends in hundreds of police. In contrast, Whitlam, you know, this kind of giant, lanky, long-legged man, goes to the tent embassy and sits down and is engaged in what appears to be very genuine dialogue. And he leaves the tent embassy saying that he will legislate land rights. So by 1972, with just himself and one other pretty much running the nation, I think it was on day 11, they announce a commission of inquiry into land rights. Justice Woodward is appointed. He'd already been working with the Yirrkala people in their litigation against the Commonwealth's decision to approve a mine some years earlier. So it was a top order issue for the Whitlam government. When the Whitlam government announced their policy plan at the Blacktown Civic Centre, what Whitlam says is the recognition of Aboriginal rights and of land rights is necessary in order to improve Australia's national shame.
We met Whitlam for the first time in the tent embassy when he came to see us. When he was then the leader of the opposition, he sat down and spoke with a group of us. We had a major problem with Gough Whitlam insofar as the land rights move was not just about the Northern Territory, it was about the whole of the Commonwealth of Australia. And we had trouble convincing him that land rights should also be applicable in New South Wales, Queensland, Western Australia, South Australia, Tasmania, and everywhere else. That took time for Whitlam and them to respond to that. Eventually they said, yes, we would support uniform national land rights. Unfortunately, Whitlam was not in power long enough for that to happen, but the notion that Aboriginal people in the States also had rights to land and we didn't surrender our rights was well and truly established, at least in the minds of Aboriginal people.
Dagaragu, as it's known in Gurindji, is now no longer part of the Wave Hill Station.
Men and women of the Gurindji people, I want to give back to you formally, in Aboriginal and in Australian law, ownership of this land of your fathers.
And with that, Mr. Whitlam bent down and picked up a handful of the red Wattie Creek dust, and in a reversal of history, returned to the Gurindjis, the land of their dreams. Firmly clutching the soil, one of the original petitioners to the Governor-General 9 years ago, Mr. Vincent Lingiari, replied.
There was this huge swell for land rights all over Australia. I actually worked on the Woodward Royal Commission, which went around talking to people in the top end of the Northern Territory about land rights, and I went to a lot of meetings with lawyers, and maps were drawn about whose country this was and where it ended and where it started, and everybody knew whose country was where. It was a huge exercise, which led, of course, to the Northern Territory Land Rights Act 1974.
The bill is probably the most progressive Land Rights Act ever passed, either at the national level or a state parliament. When I compare, and which we did do, the Land Rights Act in the Northern Territory compared to the New South Wales Land Rights Act, it was like night and day. The Land Rights Act in the Northern Territory gave the Aboriginal communities of the Northern Territory complete say over the future of their own country. And that meant having control over things like minerals, having a say as to what happens to the water. The Land Rights Act in New South Wales and elsewhere, none of those things were mentioned.
You heard the voices of Paul Coe, an Indigenous activist, author Marcia Langton, Heidi Norman, who is professor in the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at the University of Technology in Sydney, and Pat Anderson, who's the chairperson of the Loitsha Institute. You can hear the full series tracing relations between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians on Rear Vision. We'll put a link to the program on our website. For as long as Australian history books have been printed, the general story has been that Aboriginal people were just hunter-gatherers. But that's not exactly true. Author Bruce Pascoe's book, Dark Emu, showed Aboriginal Australians were using traditional agricultural practices, growing crops, tilling soil and terracing, long before white settlers arrived. Spreading the Dark Emu message through music and song has been the Bangarra Dance Theatre. Its artistic director, Stephen Page, joined author Bruce Pascoe in speaking with Michael Cathcart from The Hub on Stage about the book and the performance.
In this book, you really listen to the accounts written by the 19th century explorers who, well, they opened the way for Aboriginal dispossession. But as you show, the likes of Charles Sturt and Major Mitchell also saw and also understood a great deal.
Yeah, they were agents of the dispossession, but they also took an interest in what they were seeing of the Aboriginal economy. And they both reported Aboriginal people sowing grain, harvesting crops, storing the crops, and engaged in things that really aren't part of any hunter-gatherer society. They were involved in an agriculture.
They also describe permanent housing. They describe what they call villages. It's quite different from the idea that most people would have of what traditional Aboriginal life was like.
It is, and we need to know it, not just for the sake of learning our history, but to learn how a people of such success that they were able to manage the land for 80,000 years and still act in a sustainable fashion, what those people knew. We need to know that now because our continent is under threat from global warming. It's also under threat from some pretty ordinary farming practices in some locations, and we need to repair the earth. Mm. And Aboriginal people were able to grow food without seriously impacting the productivity of the soil. That's a pretty good trick to carry into the future.
And we should say, Bruce, that this reading of the explorers, Sturt and Mitchell and lots of others, isn't a kind of partial reading that you've done. It's not achieved by selective quotation. These insights into what Aboriginal life was like are there clear as day. And they weren't in the extracts of these journals that school kids were given to read. But if you go back and read the books as they originally published, it's all quite explicit. It's all laid out in black and white.
Yeah, it's extraordinary to think how many of the explorers referred to these things and how often they referred to them, and yet it never made it into our curriculum. I imagine the people in the 1870s, 1880s who read those journals and were thinking about writing a curriculum of history in schools, for instance, reading those things and choosing not to include them.
Or maybe they just don't understand what they're hearing. I mean, it takes you to say, in a description of Major Mitchell, he has just described going through miles and miles of harvested fields. We need you to show us what we've just read, because it can just sort of pass you by if you don't, if you're so schooled to the idea that the Aboriginals were hunter-gatherers, you will miss what actually you're being told.
Well, stook is a word that Mitchell and his fellows used. It's an English agricultural term. Mitchell's fellows say that it looked like an English field of harvest. They're the words they use, and the word stook. Lieutenant Gray uses the word tilled to describe several fields that reach to the horizon in both directions, and he couldn't walk across them because, as he said, they'd been so deeply tilled. Hillsides around Melbourne had been terraced. These are agricultural terms. They're used by Australian explorers to describe the Aboriginal economy, and they've never made it into Australian discourse.
No. And you've put it there front and centre. Now, Stephen Page, you've made a dance work out of this book. What did you particularly respond to when you read the book?
Well, I think, you know, knowing when the book had come out, and then I run into Bruce last year at the opening night of Ben Long at the Opera House, the irony of that. And we were talking, and I think there was a bit of a joke between us about adapting this book into a dance production. Now, Bangarra spit out one work a year, so we get invitations from different families and communities, and this was one of the biggest challenges I've had. And I don't know if it was the ego that sort of thought creatively, wow, this would be a challenge. And I think about 3 or 4 days later, I came back and got in contact with Bruce and said, I'm going to start trying to adapt a dance version to this response. Now, look, I don't know if I've achieved that, Bruce, or not when you saw it. I mean, you probably looked at it and went, I don't think this has got anything to do with my book. But look, I'm still fascinated. I grew up where everything was through oral storytelling and a different crazy imagination, creative upbringing. So when it gets to me and books, they're my worst enemy sometimes. I tend to struggle a lot. So this one I had to really sort of sit down and work with the playwright, Alana Valentine, and we sort of worked through the fascination and the ignorance behind a lot of these practices, Aboriginal land management, all the stuff that I had over the years. I've been in contact with stories and these practices taking place through many different sort of community relationships that I've had in the north and down south. And so this just reminded me of the opportunity of this knowledge that was not, as you both been talking about, that has not been in our curriculums, has not been in our history, but it is awakened today thanks to Bruce. So I think for me it was really, I was looking on both sides, the ignorance side, the frustration behind that, but also trying to find the emotional spirit behind blackfella time, blackfella relationship with land and seasons and climate. What this wonderful fascination, this it's almost like a choreographic practice that they would have with the land. So I was really trying to just find the spirit in that and how that could feed through to the dancers and then shape some abstract form of movement. At the end of the day, we didn't want to let the dancers be human as such. We wanted them to take on these elements of time and ocean and sky and land and seasons and grain and seed and dust and this wonderful sense of all these elements coming together. So, yeah, we were wonderfully challenged and somehow the spirit of the production just took its own shape.
Stephen, let's hear some more music from the show. This is a little of Wales of Fortune.
Money.
Music by the Sydney screen and stage composer Steve Francis for Bangarra's new show, Dark Emu. Stephen, where does this music take us?
This takes us down. Well, it's actually it's a song man called Warren Foster, who's a Ewan man, and we work with Lynn Thomas, who is a Ewan woman who is a caretaker of language and stories and certain land significance down on country down south. And I just wanted to pay respect to that nation of people and their stories, especially with what was mentioned in the book in terms of the whale story and the Bundy and Way story and the whole Alpine clan and the whole Bogong moth harvest stories. So there was a strong connection once reading all of that. And so the Ewan language and song and stories is what it was probably one of the strong clans I wanted to represent within the storytelling.
Yeah, the Ewan country is on the south coast of New South Wales, taking in Eden, Batemans Bay and Nowra. So, Bruce, where does this music take you, both in terms of the whale dimension, also the Bogong moths?
Well, I was pretty stunned when I heard it because I'm Ewan, and we were very proud that Ewan language and law was being represented. And I just the best night of all. I was like a grandfather to the show because all I had to do was turn up, listen politely, smile a fair bit, and go home.
How did you convince Bruce that this was a good idea? Because the book is so much a job of a historian at the peak of his craft, and the idea that you could dance something that's so much grounded in language, it just seems
absurd. Oh, Michael, you don't know
absurd.
How nervous I was. I kept saying to my marketing and my management team, so Bruce is coming tomorrow night. I was so nervous backstage because I was thinking, what if I've really stuffed this up? Like, what if I... You know, like it's one of the hardest things in my job is, sure it's mainstream and sure it's about putting on a show, but, you know, we carry the responsibility of cultural stories, whether they're urban or traditional or living or reconnecting or reawakening. And it's a big responsibility to find the right leaders and carers of working in those mediums and speaking to them about the integral spirit that's going to work for this stage and for this main stage and how that was going to be almost that the seed and the spirit of the whole story. So I was so glad that Bruce allowed me to, awaken those relationships in his own backyard.
Well, Bruce, you've seen the show. Is there any feedback you want to give Stephen?
I had so much faith in the company. Honestly, I just knew that it was going to work. And I had the time of my life that night.
That was Stephen Page from the Bangarra Dance Theatre and author Bruce Pascoe talking with Michael Cathcart on RN's The Hub on Stage. Dark Emu has its final performance in Sydney that Saturday, and then it heads to Canberra, Perth, Brisbane and Melbourne. That's all for this week on In Case You Missed It. Thanks for your company. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favourite podcatcher. Join me again next week for more of The Best of RN. I'm Angela Owens. Bye for now. And as we leave you, here's Indigenous artist Emily Warramurra with her song Tapsticks.